started with the main topic on hand, which is fake news, media, ideology, and power, a very important contemporary question. So just so people know, I'm going to be running this session like a whole bunch of the other ones. There's going to be heaps of time, hopefully, for discussion at the end of it. So if you've got any thoughts or questions as James is talking, please jot them down, and hopefully we'll get around to lots of discussion at the end. But I might just hand it over to James now and introduce him. So James Plessett is a long-term socialist activist from down in Melbourne, and he knows a thing or two about speaking truth to power and fighting corporate media. He is a regular contributor to Socialist Alternatives newspaper, Red Flag, particularly he's a designer, and also contributes regularly on questions of the environment, and he's got an excellent article on the disgusting corruption of the Turnbull-Morrison government in this particular edition. So check out some of James's writings by getting yourself a sub to Red Flag, but please make James feel welcome.
Okay, hi everyone. Right, so last summer I spent a nice week down in Port Ferry, which is like a lovely spot on the coast of Victoria. And I was staying at a friend's place, and they had the Herald Sun delivered every morning. I'm not a regular reader of the Herald Sun, but it is Australia's biggest selling newspaper, so I thought while I was down there, I'd give it a good look, see what they had to offer. First thing to say, the sports coverage is great. If you want to read 10 pages of AFL coverage, even in the off-season, and I definitely do, then it's unsurpassed. But as for the rest of the coverage, I'm going to take you through a few slides now to give you a sense of that. Do people on the live stream have slides, Jeremy? Okay. For people on the live stream, just imagine like a Herald Sun cover from basically any day of the week, and you get the gist. So let's have a look. All right. New menace. Merchants of menace. Gangbusters fight. Gang tackle on premier. Missing action. African gang crisis. Daniel Andrews on holidays. Deputy premier on holidays. Missing in action. Street gang crisis. No respect. Teen thug who attacked cop bailed. The brutal truth. Someone giving some kind of very, obviously very sinister gang sign there. In front of a police car. Gang raids on city. Interstate thugs behind wild brawls as government cracks down on soft sentences. All right, so that's that. You get the gist. So, coincidentally, while I was down there, I was also listening to a lot of talkback radio. Probably too much, actually. New Year's Day, I woke up listening to one of the local talkback stations, and I had a massive hangover, and all I could hear was, like, Bob from Warrnambool complaining about how his dog was frightened by fireworks. So a little bit of talkback radio, I think, is enough most of the time. Most of what we were listening to was 3AW, which, again, is Melbourne's most popular radio station. It's owned by Macquarie Media, which is majority controlled by Fairfax. And obviously Fairfax now part of Nine Network. I mention this partly to indicate that the whole African gang violence thing was very much kind of a joint project of the media in Melbourne rather than just of Rupert Murdoch. So the overall impression of the situation in Melbourne, given by the Herald Sun, 3AW, and to a greater or lesser degree, the rest of the media in Melbourne, was in a city in a state of siege. And people actually like ask me in Port Ferry, like, how do you cope with all the violence? Some of that stuff. Strangely enough, though, when I returned to Melbourne, it was all pretty safe and quiet, like as I'd left it. I could even go out for dinner at night and not fear for my life, as Peter Dutton claimed later. Now, I didn't need to actually experience returning to Melbourne to know this. As soon as you look beyond the screaming headlines in the Herald Sun to the actual content of the articles, it was immediately clear that the whole thing was a beat-up. And I really gave them a shot. Like, I read it carefully. I gave them the benefit of the doubt. I was like, look, let's see what they're going to say. They came back to the same few examples day after day. There was a brawl involving African youths in St Kilda. There was an interview with residents in the outer western suburb of Tarni who said they felt threatened by African young people hanging around in the park near where they lived. Someone kicked a cop at a shopping mall. No respect, as the headline said. Every day they printed the same few photos of a derelict community centre that had been graffitied, apparently with gang tags. and of African young people standing around in a park somewhere. As the hysteria caught hold, the media even created its own incidents to report on. On the 3rd of January, the Daily Mail ran with this screaming headline. Exclusive. Police spat on and abused as officers arrest African teenagers outside a shopping centre in Melbourne's West in broad daylight in latest gang flare-up. I know all of you can read it, but that's for the people on the live stream. All right, so that sounds very dramatic, doesn't it? Only thing is, as the police saw fit to clarify a few days later, the incident was actually provoked by a Daily Telegraph reporter, photographer, who'd approached the group of teenagers who'd just been standing around minding their own businesses and started taking close-up photographs of them. So the whole thing was just one big echo chamber between media and politics with little connection to reality. After a few days of full-volume Herald Sun headlines, you had state Liberal leader Matthew Guy stepping in to attack the Labor government over its supposed lack of action on African gang crime. And it was the Herald Sun coverage, rather than any like actual evidence of crimes or, you know, the problem that Melbourne was supposedly facing, that he referred to as evidence of the crisis. And then the next day, the Herald Sun reported on Matthew Guy's comments as if that was an independent source, contributing something very new to the whole topic. Now, of course, the Sun's coverage and Matthew Guy's comments were in reality, I think, all part of the same plan, which was probably dreamt up in a boardroom somewhere, in a meeting between Liberal Party strategists and Murdoch executives, if not Rupert Murdoch himself, to soften up the Victorian government in preparation for the coming state election. And you don't have to just take my word for it that Rupert Murdoch intervenes aggressively in Australian politics and world politics. If you're a fan of Kevin Rudd, and I hope no one here is, actually, he had a lengthy opinion piece the other day talking about Murdoch in the context of the crusade against Malcolm Turnbull as destroying democracy in Australia. So it's not just me that thinks that Murdoch does that, Kevin Rudd as well. And yeah, I mean, I guess if you control 70% of the media in Australia, which Murdoch does, then you might have a bit of a shot of actually doing that. Back to the case at hand, though. What are the facts about the supposed African gang crisis in Melbourne? It's true there have been crimes committed by people, young people of African descent in Victoria, but these make up a fraction of the overall number. It's actually 1% in the year, the statistics I saw, 1% of crimes in the year to September 2017. The vast majority of crimes are unsurprisingly committed by whites. Some of them certainly by white gangs, and some of them very probably by the kind of mafia circles who Victorian Liberal Party leader Matthew Guy had until recently been inviting to his fundraising dinners. And the reality is that the entrenched racism of our society means that black youth are heavily over-policed, which will inevitably boost their appearance in crime statistics. It's like if you're a respectable kind of looking white student from Melbourne University, you can get away with a lot of stuff which would be immediately criminalised in the context of, you know, a group of young African men in the western suburbs, like, for example, just like standing around at a shopping mall or in a park. Okay, so the topic of this talk is fake news, media ideology, and power. I thought I'd start with this example to show just how disconnected from reality much of what passes for news is in today's media landscape. Of course, though, to get a real grip on the topic, we've got to go beyond just this kind of most surface-level analysis of how the media lies. The real question is why they lie. No doubt in Herald Sun's case, it's a lot of the time just because they're bad journalists and bad people, but that's nowhere near the whole answer. And then there's the question of what we on the socialist left can do about it. How can we cut through the torrent of pro-capitalist ideological shit that flows from our computer screens, newspapers, TVs and radios, and actually get the message out about what's actually going on in our society? Because I'll tell you one thing, it's not like African gangs running rampant on the streets of Melbourne and making people too scared to go out for dinner. Okay. So the broader context for the emergence of the idea of fake news is a decline in trust in media that's occurred over the last few decades. Trust in the media is today at record lows. In Australia, just 31% of people say they trust the media. This compares unfavourably with NGOs at 48%, business at 45%, and government at 35%. And given like the state of politics today, it's like really quite something to be less trusted than the government. Like, it's quite an amazing achievement. And I don't want to just have this talk be just like one big Rupert Murdoch bashing session, enjoyable and necessary as that might be. So I've chosen a couple of other examples, significant examples, I think, that illustrate the trend. The first one I want to talk about is the media's coverage of the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq in 2003. This was arguably the most significant geopolitical event of the 21st century to date, and also probably the most disastrous. The invasion and subsequent occupation of Iraq came at the cost of an estimated million lives lost, and a destabilization that's plunged the entire Middle East into seemingly unending war. So on balance, it probably wasn't really a good idea. In the lead-up to the invasion, however, basically all of the so-called serious commentators were united in their view that something had to be done to stop Saddam Hussein and this supposed cache of weapons of mass destruction. Perhaps the most respectable and supposedly authoritative news source of all, the New York Times, led the charge. In the year leading up to the invasion, the Times basically transformed itself into a propaganda arm of the Bush administration. So on the 7th of September 2002, for example, the Times published a front-page article by Judith Miller and Michael Gorton, which claimed that Iraq had stepped up its quest for nuclear weapons and embarked on a worldwide hunt for materials to make an atomic bomb. It argued further that Iraq's push to improve and expand Baghdad's chemical and biological arsenals had brought Iraq and the United States close to the brink of war. Now, this is on a much bigger scale, but it's quite similar to the kind of African gang stuff, because the only sources they cited for this information were unnamed American officials and intelligence experts. And the day after the story was published, Bush administration officials like Condoleezza Rice, Colin Powell, and Donald Rumsfeld were all over the news, just like literally just promoting the New York Times front page story as evidence, independent evidence in support of their pro-war position. So once again, what you have is just this media and politics echo chamber. And of course, the lead given by the Times was followed slavishly by newspapers around the world. So as I'm in Sydney, we'll take some from the Sydney Morning Herald. So in September 2002, which is when the New York Times article came out, the Sydney Morning Herald ran with a slew of headlines beating the drum for war. On 6 September, it was a quote from George W. Bush. "To do nothing about that serious threat is not an option." On 10 September, it was, "Iraq is going nuclear fast, world warned." On 18 September, Saddam playing tricks, says US. And on 25th September, "Saddam ready and able to strike." Now, I think Jeff Sparrow, left-wing journalist Jeff Sparrow, sums it up nicely when he writes that in 2002 and 2003, journalistic seriousness over Iraq was defined by participation in the feedback loop between pro-war reporters and pro-war politicians, who leaned upon each other like drunks at closing time, repeating and amplifying the claims of the Bush and Blair administrations. Now, of course, most of the supposed evidence that these kind of stories were based on turned out to be completely fabricated, which the media might have actually cottoned onto if they kind of reached out beyond the sources that they had that were actually embedded within the very governments that were leading the drive to war. So none of this was really journalism, I'd say, in like the kind of traditional idealistic sense. It was propaganda. And since then, if anything, things have gotten worse. A more current example I want to talk about is the British media's treatment of Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn. So again, we're not just talking here about explicitly conservative outlets like The Sun and The Daily Mail. Basically, the entire spectrum of British media has been campaigning against Corbyn since he was elected Labour Party leader in 2015. And I can't help laughing when I see newspapers like The Guardian pontificating about the proliferation of fake news and the supposed manipulation of public opinion via social media platforms like Facebook. The British media's coverage of Corbyn, including The Guardian, has been nothing but a campaign to manipulate public opinion in order to undermine the democratically elected and very, very popular leader of a political party with over 500,000 members. And the blatant bias of the coverage isn't just, you know, my opinion, you know, as a lefty. The London School of Economics actually did a study of editorial content of 8 British newspapers over a 2-month period following Corbyn's election as Labour leader in 2015. They found that less than 10% of articles about Corbyn were positive, while almost 60% were critical or openly antagonistic. I'll just show you some slides to give you a sense. So this is from when he was elected to Labour Party leader. Here's some other ones that, yeah, bye-bye Labour. As Corbyn becomes leader, it is bye-bye Labour. Okay, I'll wait for that one. So the campaign continued right up to the British election, which was held in June last year. And when Theresa May called the election, like, everyone just thought this is going to be a landslide. So this gives you a sense. Yeah, May heads for an election landslide. And then, yeah, continuing right up to the election, the Sun, I think the day of the election. Oh, yeah, and then there were the terror attacks in Britain during that time, and this is kind of how they were reported on that. But despite the relentless media campaign against him, and despite the 2-year-long campaign of backbiting by Blairites within the party, Corbyn only very narrowly lost. Labour got 40% of the vote, just behind the Tories on 42.5%. And Labour's vote was up 9.5% from the last election in 2015, which is the biggest swing between elections since 1945. So that's just a graph showing you that it's the biggest swing to Labour since Clement Attlee in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War. And this is kind of how the media responded to that. Kind of a good headline. Right. All right, so among other things you could say about this, it's testimony to the fact that the mainstream media actually has less significance on public opinion than it might hope. In fact, The Guardian actually had a big whinge about this sort of in the later part of the election campaign when it became clear that Corbyn was going to do much better than people expected. They noted that out of the top 20 most shared articles about the election, only 2 were from the mainstream media, complaining that, quote, "Nothing from the BBC, The Guardian, or the Daily Mail comes close to the greatest hit of the campaign so far, a blog post subheadlined, 'If you insist on blibber-blabbering about how Jeremy Corbyn is so unelectable, could you at least tell us how many of his policies you disagree with and why?'" So they were really mad about that kind of thing being read. Now, Corbyn's obvious popularity with voters forced some of the media to change their tune. This, however, couldn't last. Now, at a time when Labour's actually well-placed to win the next election, if it happens, we're seeing a renewed assault, this time centred on claims of anti-Semitism in the party. And again, the whole thing is more or less just a beat-up. Clearly, there have been instances of anti-Semitism in the British Labour Party. I mean, how could it be otherwise in a party with over 500,000 members? Suffice to say, though, that the actual cases referred to by the media are very thin on the ground and mostly are on the level of someone posting something that can be interpreted as anti-Semitic in a Facebook, you know, rank-and-file Labour Party member Facebook group somewhere. And because the right-wing attacks on the party and on Corbyn have been going on around this issue, have been going on since he became leader, they've actually paid much more attention to cracking down on anti-Semitic views within the party than probably any other political party in the world. This hasn't stopped the media, however, running like months and months of screaming headlines about the British Labour Party's supposed anti-Semitism crisis. Yep, Corbyn's hate factory. Corbyn loses the plot. Party's a sewer. Yep. Yep. Okay, so clearly some of this is being driven by pro-Israeli Jewish groups in Britain whose real target is Corbyn's long-term support for the Palestinians. It's unthinkable to them that a possible future, and the rest of the British establishment, frankly, that a possible future British Prime Minister would be anything other than an unflinching supporter of everything Israel does. In July, the three main Jewish newspapers in Britain, which are all staunchly pro-Israel, published the same front page, which claimed a Corbyn government would pose an existential threat to Jewish life in Britain. Now, I think if the media really did uphold traditional journalistic values, you might expect that claims like this might come under a bit of scrutiny. Is a long-time anti-racist campaigner like Corbyn really going to commit a genocide against the Jewish population of Britain if he gets into government? But of course, it didn't matter to the media that the claims are so outlandish. What matters to them is that they got another weapon to wield in their long-term campaign against Corbyn. The levels of hysteria, like, I don't know if people have been following it, but like, it's kind of hard to convey like how hysterical the coverage is, but it's basically like anything Corbyn does is can be interpreted as anti-Semitic. Like, he went to he was invited to a Passover dinner with a Jewish group who were critical of Israel, and he went to a Passover dinner, and that became another thing that he was accused of being anti-Semitic for, but it's all kind of like along those lines. Now, I think if the media really did care about rooting out anti-Semitism, you might expect them to scrutinise right-wing politics as closely as they scrutinised the Labour Party. Because to the extent that we're seeing a rise in anti-Semitism in parts of the world today, it's almost entirely associated with the rise of the far right. The right-wing government of Austria, for example, recently proposed to force Jews to register with the state if they want to buy kosher meat. And studies have shown that in Britain itself, Tory voters are much more likely to have anti-Semitic views than Labour supporters. And I think this shouldn't come as any surprise, given that the British ruling class kind of anti-Semitism over the last century that led actually a lot of them to be staunch supporters of Hitler during that time. So once again, in the media's campaign around anti-Semitism in the British Labour Party, what we have is not much to do with actual journalism. What we have here is propaganda rather than news. Okay. So I think the fake news fad that is currently going on has to be seen in this context. The media, whether openly right-wing like the Murdoch Press or more liberal like The Guardian, has again and again proven willing to peddle the most barefaced lies and distortions as authoritative and objective reporting. It's not surprising, then, that the fake news label is being used by politicians both of the left and the right. For right-wing populists like Trump, of course, it's the more liberally inclined outlets like the New York Times and CNN that are the main peddlers of fake news. And on the far, like the kind of far lunar right, you actually have people like Alex Jones from InfoWars who argue that basically everything you read in the mainstream press is just like a conspiracy by globalists to take over the world, basically. Now, all of this is clearly insane. but I think it's kind of a bit rich for newspapers like the New York Times to complain about being labelled fake news by Trump, given their preparedness over the past few decades to peddle blatant lies and distortions as, you know, actually factual reporting. I think it was inevitable in this context that you'd have someone like Trump come along for whom truth is just basically anything that whatever suits their interests at the time. And arguably no less insane than the Alex Joneses of the world are those on the liberal left side who worry that the spread of information through Facebook and so on has left Western voters open to manipulation by fake news originating in Russia or wherever else their fevered imaginations might suppose. Now, again, the level of kind of hysteria here has reached such heights, it's really insane. Some commentators have even raised the possibility that this kind of fake news could be a threat to Western capitalist democracy. And clearly, this is just ridiculous. take the Russian meddling in the US election. It's true, the Russians set up something that, you know, sounds shadowy and scary called the Internet Research Agency, which employed 80 people to try and influence US politics through social media platforms like Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And I mean, is that a crime? Like, I try to influence politics through Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. According to the US authorities themselves, though, these groups only had a reach at their peak of like a few hundred thousand people. And to put this in perspective, Around 124 million people voted in the US presidential election, and Hillary Clinton actually got 3 million more votes than Trump. She didn't lose the election because of Russian interference. She lost because of the highly undemocratic nature of the US electoral system, which is something that the Democrats, notably, have been very unwilling to change. So clearly there is such a thing as fake news, in the sense that, you know, stories that people somewhere, someone in a dark room somewhere just, like, you know, types out, that's, like, completely fabricated. But this represents a drop in the ocean of the media that people actually engage with. What's much more common and much more threatening to democracy are the very mainstream examples I've talked about. Not clickbait emerging from the darkest corners of the internet, but the apparently very serious and authoritative reporting of the world's biggest media companies, including the most liberal outlets like The Guardian and The New York Times. Which doesn't mean I agree with Trump, just for the record. As I said, for Trump, fake news is anything that just doesn't uncritically accept his own lies. And clearly the media isn't simply making things up in the way that he implies. They don't sit down at the start of each day and talk about which lies they can peddle in order to, you know, further a particular political agenda. It's all a bit more kind of complicated than that. The first thing to say, I think, and to be fair to people who might be journalism students, it's not primarily a problem with the individual journalists. There are certainly a lot of people who work for newspapers like the Herald Sun that are just complete utter scum, like Andrew Bolt, for example. But most people who end up working as journos don't go there with the intention of being part of a pro-corporate propaganda machine serving the masses their daily dose of capitalist ideology. I'm sure if we went out after the talk and went and interviewed some Sydney Uni journalism students or wherever else they study journalism in Sydney, probably most of them would tell you that they hope to play their part in uncovering the truth, keeping the public informed about global events, exposing corruption, and so on. I don't think journalism, especially these days, is really the kind of profession that's going to attract people who just want to make a bunch of money by any means necessary. And if they do think that, then they're going to be very disappointed. The problem doesn't lie with the individual, it lies with the institution. Left-wing Australian journalist Alex Mitchell puts it well. Journalists who delude themselves into believing that they work for the free press should try writing about bankers as blood-sucking parasites, and they'll quickly discover that bankers, who are regular attendees at newspaper boardroom lunches, control immense advertising budgets and must be given grave respect. And I think this points to the real reason why the mainstream media is basically just a tool for manufacturing consent, as Chomsky famously put it. That is, the media itself is big business. Its fundamental role isn't to keep the public informed, but to make money for the capitalists who own it. And a number of things, I think, flow from this. First, and most obviously, those like Rupert Murdoch, who own the media, will tend to have a lot of kind of input into what kind of stuff they put out. And of course, if you're rich enough to own a media empire, you're unlikely to be much of a critic of capitalism. More likely, as with Murdoch, you'll use your position to promote the kind of politics that best suits your business interests. Such is the case, for example, with the Herald Sun's coverage of the so-called African gang crisis in Melbourne. So clearly this coverage is racist, but I'd argue that it's not racism that's driving it. Like, the columnists at the Herald Sun aren't just like, you know, I really hate, like, young African men. Racism is the means to the end of, first, selling newspapers, and second, attacking the Andrews Labor government and giving a boost to the prospects of the Liberal Party in the upcoming state election. So that's one part of it. I say that the political commitments of media owners, however, are only half the story. What if, hypothetically, someone in the room today somehow got hold of a few hundred million dollars and used it to set up their own left-wing media empire to compete with the right-wing outlets that currently dominate? Let's all imagine that for a second. It's a nice thought. The first problem you'd encounter is how to secure ongoing funding from investors and advertisers. Unfortunately, it's not very common for left-wing people to have a lot of money just to spend on this kind of thing. And if you do, if you're one of those people, you should talk to me afterwards. Mostly it's big corporations. And they aren't going to like it very much. If your newspapers and TV stations and radio stations are constantly railing against the rich, most likely they'll tell you to change your tune or they'll take their business elsewhere. The second big problem you'd have is how to get content. The media depends on their connections with people in power, so like politicians, corporate executives, senior public servants, and so on, to provide them with the information that they need for their stories. To establish and maintain these relationships depends on them publishing stories that align with the interests of their sources. Like, they can't just keep going back to a source who every time they go to them, they just trash them, like in the mainstream media. And I think this is an important part of the explanation, actually, for the British media's relentless campaign against Corbyn. The negative stories reflect the fact that Corbyn is despised by the entire British establishment. Responding to the report into biased coverage of Corbyn that I mentioned earlier, Guardian media commentator Roy Greenslade said, I'm not in the least surprised by the coverage of Corbyn. With something like 80% of this parliamentary party against him, would democracy benefit from a failure to reflect that reality? Okay. I guess it would never occur to someone like Greenslade that a newspaper shouldn't just mirror the views of the establishment political and business circles with which they themselves are connected. Another issue you'd face with your new media empire is the pressure that you would face to churn out the maximum amount of content in the minimum amount of time. This has always been the case to some degree with the media, but it's gotten massively worse in the last decade or so with the kind of diversification of media, the shift to online content, and so on. It's the nature of the media today that to gain and maintain an audience, you need to keep up a relentless pace. The vast majority of journos don't have time to do extensive research, follow up a range of sources, independently verify information, and so on. More and more of the content they produce is sourced directly from media releases, and, you know, other sources of information from PR companies, you know, the government, and so on. And a 2008 study by Cardiff University of 2,000 UK news stories found that only 12% of stories comprise material wholly sourced from research of the journalists themselves. A massive 80% of the stories were wholly, mainly, or partially made up of secondhand material provided by news agencies and the PR industry. And given the massive cuts to journalistic budgets over like the last decade since 2008, we can assume that that's got worse to today. And like, if you look down Sydney Morning Herald and or the Age website today, you actually see like a lot of the stories are sponsored by different corporations, which gives you a sense that it's just outright advertising that's going on. All right. So the political and business establishment has the power, the money, and importantly for the media, the information. To succeed with your media empire, you'll be forced to accommodate yourself to this reality. What this means, of course, is that unfortunately for whoever got the $300 million, a left-wing media empire under capitalism is a contradiction in terms. The mainstream media is and will remain an institution of ruling class power. In line with this, while the news it reports may not be straightforwardly fake in the sense that people like Trump mean it, it inevitably reflects and in turn helps construct the worldview of the capitalist class. Now, I don't want to imply that there's just absolutely no wiggle room in this. Clearly, mainstream news outlets actually do produce quality content sometimes and actually do sometimes employ good journalists, left-wing journalists, like, for example, Jeff Sparrow, who I've quoted. But the entire spectrum of the mainstream media, from the most liberal to the most right-wing, shares some core pro-capitalist assumptions that basically are never questioned. And it goes without saying that any major challenge to these assumptions will be treated savagely. And you, if you look at how they've treated Corbyn in Britain, Corbyn sort of, you know, got this kind of mild, relatively form of left reformism. Like, if there was a genuine socialist challenge, you can imagine kind of what the media would be like. Okay. So to start to kind of wind up, the final thing to talk about is how can we counter all of this? In a world dominated by capitalist ideology, with a massive corporate media machine functioning 24/7 to help reinforce and maintain it, what hope is there that a socialist perspective can break through. And first off, I think it's important to underline, to encounter the idea that the mass of ordinary people just accept what the media tells them uncritically. Contrary to what you sometimes hear around the left, people aren't just brainwashed drones. The example of Corbyn, I think, is very clear on that. Despite the years of negative coverage from the entire spectrum of media in Britain, his popularity has actually barely been dented. If anything, it's the popularity of the media that suffered. In the face of the negative coverage, many people have simply sought out alternative media sources online. Now, in this context, I think there is a bit of an opening for kind of more genuinely radical news sources on a small scale like Red Flag. And also you can see in like the US, for example, with something like Jacobin magazine, which, you know, has tens of thousands of subscribers, that there is a bit of potential out there. So clearly, one part of the answer is to further build up our own newspapers, websites, podcasts, if you're feeling creative, and other media that can report on and interpret world events from the perspective of workers and the oppressed. But unfortunately, I don't think that's the whole story. To understand how socialist politics could really break through on a mass level, we've got to go back to Marx's understanding of how ideas change. So, in classic quote from the German ideology. Okay. So both for the production on a mass scale of communist consciousness and for the success of the cause itself, the alteration of men on a mass scale is necessary, an alteration which can only take place in a practical movement, a revolution. This revolution is necessary, therefore, not only because the ruling class cannot be overthrown in any other way, but also because the class overthrowing it can only in a revolution succeed in ridding itself of all the muck of ages and become fitted to found society anew. So in ordinary times, we live out our daily lives in a state of powerlessness and isolation. In this context, while we may be very cynical about the mainstream media, most people aren't going to seek out the kind of radical material that can systematize cynicism into a fully fledged radical worldview. When we enter into struggle, however, a couple of very important things happen. First, it can bring into really stark relief just how hostile the mainstream media is to the basic kind of experiences and aspirations of ordinary people. You might think that your strike for better wages or your march against war or whatever are just and completely rational, but that's not how it's going to be reported in the Herald Sun. The second thing is that by taking action, we can come to identify ourselves as part of a collective whose interests are directly opposed to those of the rich and powerful, and that can also, in the case of workers, be a powerful force to disrupt society and drive change. And when these two things combine, you can get a powerful thirst for knowledge that can quickly start to radicalize consciousness on a mass scale. And there's probably heaps of examples from history, but the really, really classic one is the US journalist John Reed's famous account of life in Petrograd at the height of the Russian Revolution, where he writes, "All Russia was learning to read and reading, politics, economics, history, because the people wanted to know. Hundreds of thousands of pamphlets were distributed by thousands of organizations and poured into the armies, the villages, the factories, the streets. Russia absorbed reading matter like hot sand drinks water, insatiable." So to conclude, we can't expect a socialist press to break through on a mass scale from the top down. The domination of capitalist media is maintained not just because they've got so many more resources and reach than us, but because we live in a society where people feel passive and powerless most of the time. And for this to change, we need a mass movement to challenge the humdrum reality of everyday life under capitalism. And that's why, to finish, the role of the socialist press isn't simply to kind of educate people. What it should be, ideally, is a weapon in the class struggle.